Hello, beautiful people. You are now listening to season 3 of the Platinum Rule podcast. Our priority is to give our listeners the most recent information about current events, public policy, activism, and much, much more.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Platinum Rule podcast.
Hi.
I am Amari, and this is Sophia here with me. Per usual, how are you doing today, Sophia?
I'm doing good. We're recording right now. I'm looking at the sunset. It's a good day. How are you?
I'm good. I'm looking at myself in my vanity mirror.
views on views.
Yes, views on views.
Hype your girls up.
Sophia and I were actually just together yesterday, which is super exciting because I don't know if you guys know this, but we never see each other face to face. It's very, very rare that we actually get to hang out. So that was lovely.
Morning was filled with lots of business, lots of art, tons of coffee.
We had lunch and we actually...
Oh, yes.
We actually spoke with a very special guest. So make sure you guys keep tuning in because we're going to have a really great episode coming up for you all soon.
Were you starstruck? You've mentioned her before.
Yes. If you guys, I want you guys to try to go back and guess and see who's going to be on the pod. You guys won't get it. It's okay.
So stay tuned in a couple of weeks. Yeah. Honestly, it was just what I needed. A good little break away from reality. And it was so nice to see you, friend.
It was good seeing you too. I'm glad you got to come. And in a more somber note, we want to take the time to just read our George Floyd statement to address the trial that just ended last week. As minority women in America, we recognize, experience, and acknowledge the discrimination against BI POC in our nation. On 4/20/2021, the city of Minneapolis found Dee Chauvin guilty on all counts in the murder of George Floyd. Although there is more justice to be served, we hope the Floyd family and everyone who has been affected by this murder feels the slightest sense of relief. To keep it 100 with you guys, I personally made the decision to not fully discuss what's going on right now due to my own uncomfortability and the way that I'm processing what's going on in the nation that I live in. And that's that on that.
Mm-hmm. I hear you. I see you. And I can respect that. So moving on, let's just get into this week's episode. I'm glad we got to share that, though. And thank you, Amari, for actually sharing that, too. Okay.
Absolutely.
Okay, on a different note.
While I would usually, at this point of the podcast, go down a laundry list of headliners, I'm going to switch it up on you guys. While Sophia and I were developing the agenda for this season's episodes, we thought it would be a good idea to incorporate public policy discussions and well-known governmental concepts. Because these subjects can get boring, I will be providing you all with rapid-fire info for you to take with you on your journey. Here we go. First, has anyone heard of the revolving door? Sophia, have you ever heard of the revolving door?
I'll be honest. No, I don't think so.
Now, Sophia, can you describe the revolving door if you were to guess?
Well, a revolving door to me sounds like kind of like a cycle that can't be broken.
That's a...
Amari shaking her head yes. Like, am I just making a good guess right now?
Yes, a very intelligent guess. If you don't know what the revolving door is, that's what I'm here for. The revolving door, also known as how to become a millionaire as a public servant, is basically an exchange. Politicians or public servants of any kind will need funds for campaigns or to sustain their job. So, large donors and corporations alike will donate those funds. Once that public servant is in a position of power, it is then time to pay those donors back. The person in power can do things like write laws or manipulate policy information to benefit those donors. Then, once they're not in power anymore, they could potentially become a donor to someone else. So if you think about it as a revolving door, you see a crooked politician walk in with corporate funds, then they win and receive power, then they manipulate law and policy, and are free to do it again.
Okay, let's shift gears to the topic of this episode. We're going to be talking about judgment, bias, and how it affects fact from just opinion. We were curious what you guys had to say about judgment, being judged, and judging others. With that, we're going to take it to our Phone a Friend segment where we pass the mic to you guys. Be ready when we call you. What is something that you feel judged about?
Something I feel judged about, honestly, I feel like it's been like this since I've grown up, but being Indian in a way, I don't know, like people just make fun of you. It was racist actually. Like growing up, people would call me like a camel junkie or like, you know, the S word, the sand, whatever. But I feel like that's the most that I've gotten judged about that's actually like hurt my genuine feelings.
Yeah. Do you feel like that still happens today?
I feel like some people think they can just like make fun of like things that Indians do. Don't make it in a way that you're going to be making fun of me. I feel like, or like, oh, do your parents own a gas station? Like, that's so annoying.
Yeah. Do you feel like it affects the way you think about yourself?
I feel like when growing up, I think I had like an identity crisis.
Yeah. So did I, honestly. I took a class in college, but that made me like even realize that I had like a culture identity crisis going on.
Not in a sense that I was being bullied, but like genuinely growing up, it was hard for me to like have friends that like didn't make fun of me over stuff like that. But yeah, I think that's the honestly used to make me really upset. Definitely an identity crisis. And I felt like I needed to have a lot of Caucasian friends to fit in.
Yeah. Well, it's made you the person you are today. Super happy to know you.
Thank you.
What is something that you have felt judged about?
Oh, man. Dang, that's a good one. So I think that I feel judged, and this is going to be deep, but maybe even about my family. Like, when people don't know, I feel like I keep it undercover so people do not judge me. I don't want people to think less of me, but is it in regards to cultural?
Do you think cultural bias has an effect on what you feel judged about, or do you think it's something totally different?
I don't think it's cultural bias for myself, at least. I think what I am concerned about being judged about is more of just the dynamic of my family. I guess the culture, just because of what we were raised in. Mm-hmm. So I don't want you to judge me off of my family's problems or the things that we possibly go through, because it gets deep.
Yeah.
Gets deep.
Thank you to our last few listeners for answering that question. Now we're going to flip the script and hear the opposite answers. I have a quick question for you. What do you find yourself judging other people for?
That's actually a really interesting question, considering essentially all the things that I've been going through recently. But I think authenticity, if I don't think that someone is being authentic, then I'm questioning and wondering why, and I'm judging whatever their reason is for not being their truest, most authentic self.
Yeah, honestly, I was really interested to see what people's answers would be, and genuinely curious about what people feel judged for. But I mean, everybody at one point feels judged or has definitely judged another person. Anything off the top of mind that you feel judged about or that you judge other people about?
Sometimes I feel like people assume my personality and put me in a box, although I, you know, make an effort to be multidimensional. So I think assuming someone's entire personality off of social media posts and a few conversations just isn't accurate. So we all got to be a little bit open-minded.
Yes.
I think it's about that time to get into the meat of the episode. We have an wonderful guest for you guys this week, but we want to give you guys a little bit of background before we get into the interview.
So one thing that comes with judgment is a pre-bias. That leads to a question of why should we aim to point out these biases that come with judgment? Where and how does it exist?
There are three main examples of cultural bias. One, at the workplace, that can be involved in the hiring process, depending on names, if you're in entertainment, your cover photo, and things like that. In public, the assumption that one set of norms is correct And kind of like how Sophia was saying, you see someone's outwards appearance and you assume their entire background. And lastly, at school, specifically in the United States, cultural bias may lead to educators treating certain students differently and having discrepancies in education. It's really critical to point out what's wrong about the information that we trust in, especially what we learn and absorb. And the first part of doing it is identifying what biases exist and how we learned them, and then to share the discrepancies. So, to address that, we're talking anthropology.
She is a former facilitator at AmeriCorps for Children at Risk, University of California, Berkeley anthropology alum and proposition queen. Many of our mutual friends know her as a literal walking encyclopedia. It's Callan Lappin. Welcome. We're so happy to have you on this week's episode. So tell us about your background.
So my name is Callan. I studied anthropology at UC Berkeley, graduated in 2019. My specific focus is cultural anthropology, and then even within that, cultural policy. So I'm super interested in museums. I actually worked at a museum of anthropology for about 3 years, and that's where I learned the most about modern anthropology.
For those who don't really know what anthropology is or kind of have a broad idea, could you give us like a little rundown of what exactly is anthropology?
Absolutely. Anthropology is literally the study of humans, and there are different sub-disciplines within it that really just depend on how we try to answer those questions about what it means to be human and how we define that. So there's archaeological anthropology, which studies humans through material culture. There's cultural anthropology, like I mentioned, that's my field, which is really focused on how culture is generated and how it varies across different regions and within different populations. And then there's biological anthropology or physical anthropology, which is what most people tend to think of, that studies evolution and human development, as well as like forensic anthropology, for example, would be a subset of that field. Kind of a way to think about it is that all the different disciplines are concerned about what it means to be human, but archaeologists try to answer that by looking at what can we learn about people through the objects they leave behind. And cultural anthropologists try to answer that by what can we learn about people through existing and historic cultures. And biological anthropologists try to answer that by looking at human evolution. So what does it mean to be human in terms of morphology, development, genealogy, a bunch of fun stuff that I don't consider myself an expert at all in. Another probably simpler way of putting it, there's a quote that I really like that sometimes is attributed to Alfred Kroeber and sometimes is attributed to Eric Wolf, but it's anthropology is the most humanistic of the sciences and the most scientific of the humanities.
Oh, that is wonderful.
This is how it got started. What comes to mind when I say that?
Yeah, so genuinely the sentence that came to mind when you said that was anthropology is super racist, because it is. Its foundations are in racism. So there are a lot of different ways to really define when anthropology started, but most modern definitions all agree that it started with different categorizations of humans. Trying to think of, like, I don't know how far back to bring you. Carl Linnaeus, for example, had one of the most famous categorizations of humans. He broke humans into 5 different groups, which were European, African, Asian, and American. And then the 5th group was a catch-all called monstrosities.
Oh, goodness.
Exactly. It's people who were born with birth defects, deformities, or disabilities. Super, super messed up.
And what's so wild about those classifications is what that probably shaped the foundation of how humans viewed other humans.
Exactly. So that was 1767. Also, what's interesting about that is that's considered like a foundational work, Systema Naturae, for science, because most of it was categorizing animals, plant species, but also humans. The 18th century really was characterized by this idea that humans were subject to the same principles that were being used to understand animals through science. Yeah, that's why people were interested in human evolution. And then you get someone like Johann Blumenbach, who comes up with another 5 categories of humans. What's important to specify is on a continuum. So it's not just like, hey, there are 5 different types of people. It's there is an ideal type of person and 4 other categories of people that fall variously beneath it. And of course, according to these men, the ideal type of person was the white person. And so everything else was considered a degraded version of that, that should be aspiring to be white. So even this very first attempt to categorize humans into different groups is derived from racism.
Wow. And would you say that recognizing that racism is what made you socially conscious enough to study this, or was it multiple factors on top of that that made you feel like it was something that you wanted to be a part of?
I had almost kind of the inverse experience, where I had no idea when I started studying anthropology that it was so rooted in racism. Anthropology was sold to me as this field that you could use to just study the stories of people and learn about the world, and it had this reputation in my experience of being completely tolerant, that you studied anthropology if you cared about other people and wanted to understand them. And it wasn't until maybe junior year, when I took this class called History of Anthropological Thought, that they actually sat us down and said, these are the founders of anthropology. They founded anthropology because they had an investment in codifying and defining racist values. And here's how we have moved forward from that. I did kind of have a period of disillusionment of, why am I studying this if this is what it's based on? And the way that I processed it and was able to still love anthropology is that modern anthropologists are working very hard to undo that work. In fact, there's almost this attitude of, because anthropologists recognize that they really gave a lot of credence to scientific racism, that they are also the ones trying to undo it. So a good example of that is Franz Boas, who is considered the father of American anthropology. He studied all of these other works that focused a lot on like craniometry and anthropometry, which was like really measuring people to try to say, okay, if your skull is this size and shape, you belong to this racial group. If you are this tall, you belong to this racial group, trying to come up with standardized categories for races. And looking at this body of work, realized that none of that worked, because as we know now in the 21st century, races are completely culturally defined. They have no biological basis. Because of that, Franz Boas built a lot of his work on this idea of building tolerance for other races, because he realized that there was no biological basis, that race was not a determinant of future success. I'm not going to say he was a huge proponent of equal rights. He also started pushing anthropology in the direction of cultural relativism, of evaluating cultures based on their own merits in their own context, instead of trying to assert a hierarchy of culture.
And what's so interesting about that is what he subconsciously did was completely disenfranchise the thought of white supremacy. His study completely went against all of those ideals.
I could talk about anthropology forever, even the complicated parts of it. But one of the things I was talking to Sophia about that I love is that anthropology at its best is one of the few sciences that encourages you to be free of judgment. There is no foregone conclusion when you are doing anthropology, quote unquote, correctly. So the example I gave for this was, I took a class called Therapeutic Cosmologies in Latin America, which looked at different systems of approaching medicine, specifically in South American cultures. We looked at shamanic traditions. We looked at hypnosis. We looked at all of these different types of medicines that would not be considered valid in Western culture. And on the first day, the professor sat us down and said, I know that you guys are going to be sitting here thinking, is hypnosis real? Is there any merit in hallucinogenic medicine? Are shamans real? And I want you to know, that's not the purpose of this class. We're not here to evaluate whether that's real or not, whether it's good or not. We're just here to understand how it works. And so there is this underlying principle of, if somebody believes something and it's real to them, then you treat it as fact. Because as long as they are existing in a world where it is real, then their experience makes it real, because they are reacting to it as if it is something that is real. So I love that anthropology lets you explore these much bigger ideas without having to be judgmental, without having to, I'm trying to think of how to phrase this, really asserting value judgments of, this is good or bad, real or non-real, what should we be striving for? Anthropology at its best is not concerned with that. It's concerned with understanding what's important to people and why.
When we talked, we said ways that anthropology, archaeology had been missing mark because of the lack of women representation.
Context that we brought this up initially in was, I was talking about how the fundamental flaw with anthropology is that it's the study of people by people. And so not only can you not separate it from the biases within the cultures you're studying, you cannot separate it from the bias within your own culture, or the culture of the person who is doing the studying.
Absolutely.
Yeah, exactly. So it continuously reproduces bias. And racism is one of the most important ways that we need to acknowledge that, because it's so foundational to the way that anthropology was formed in the United States. But it also exists with other forms of bias, namely sexism, misogyny, all kinds of bias. But it's really cool the way that people have approached addressing that. And one of the foundational ways of addressing that has been including more women in archaeology and anthropology. There's actually this whole term called feminist archaeology that emerged in the 70s and 80s, kind of around the same time as second wave feminism, where there were these hugely important feminist archaeologists or female archaeologists, they don't necessarily have to be feminists, who, when they started interpreting material culture, realized that the way that we had been approaching it in the past was really filtering it through the lens of our own expectations. So a pretty straightforward example of this is, let's say you see a painting of a naked woman. In our society, a naked woman is inherently sexual. And so someone who was studying archaeology before a lot of women were included might look at this and say, this is pornographic. This is an objectified woman. This shows that women have no power in this society. But a woman who is in the second wave feminist movement, which focused a lot on liberation and self-expression, might look at that and say, this is an empowered woman, or even this is a celebration of fertility. Honestly, either of those could be inaccurate, which I think is really interesting because both of those are being filtered through specific expectations. But I do really like the idea of feminist archaeology as a way of saying that you can really only understand a culture through different lenses if you are allowing it to be interpreted through different lenses, which means women need to be in the room, queer people need to be in the room, disabled people need to be in the room, people of color need to be in the room, which is why it's so important to make anthropology accessible to all people.
Those conclusions are so on it. If it's going to be an immersive study, every single factor of it has to be included. Otherwise, going around in circles, feeding each other, you know, false information. Do you have any other examples of anthropology in current society? Something that we see and experience now that is founded in anthropology?
So a really good example of this is I just started reading this book called Superior by Angela Saini, which is about, literally the subtitle of it is The Return of Race Science. And she talks a lot about how the eugenics movement is founded in anthropology. In fact, the father of genetics was a cousin of Charles Darwin, and a lot of his work was built off of Charles Darwin's theories of evolution. And the book does a really good job of explaining that there are all these modern concepts that we don't think of as rooted in eugenics that absolutely are, that keep reappearing in society. Even just the way that we have museums. The first whole chapter is about the British Museum, which I have very strong feelings on, because they are at the center of the debate about repatriation, of who owns museum artifacts and should they be returned to the countries that they were pillaged from? Should descendant communities have a say in what happens to them? My answer to both of those is yes. But when we talk about these conversations of repatriation, there is a very racially charged undertone to it, that the British Museum has this idea of this is all British culture because most of the artifacts come from countries that they colonized. When they put them in the museum, it wasn't to say, look at all these countries and all of the greatness they're capable of. It was to say, look at how great we are because we conquered these countries. And so the fact that they still have those artifacts, and a lot of them are still presented in the same way. So even just an example of the Elgin marbles, which were taken from Athens, from the Parthenon. If you look at the displays there, they say, these came to the British Museum in such and such year. They were given to Lord Elgin for such and such reason. They don't even begin to broach the subject of the really contentious debate of who actually owns them. And if that's how they're treating artifacts from Greece, how are they treating artifacts from every other country that they've colonized? Another good example of that is the Moai statue that they have. I believe it's called Hoa Hakananea. So that was taken from Rapa Nui. And that actually, within Rapa Nui culture, Moai, who are like the big Easter Island heads, is how they're more commonly known. You probably recognize it from Night at the Museum, which is a very simplistic representation. They actually represent the spirits of ancestors and are considered as to have as much sanctity as a human body. So the fact that it's in the British Museum is such a slap in the face to an existing culture. And there's no recognition of that in the signage of the British Museum.
Do you see that transcending into American museums?
Absolutely. The British Museum is just one that's talked about the most because it's considered like the museum of the world.
Gotcha.
But even just looking at, I guess the most typical American museums would be the Smithsonian museums, including the Museum of Natural History, the Museum of the American Indian, all kinds of different branches. I know the Museum of Natural History has not really been updated since it was first set up. In fact, Franz Boas, the father of American anthropology, set up the Pacific Northwest Native American Cultures Wing.
Jeez.
Yeah, and that was in like 1920 or something. That was 100 years ago. And it's been largely untouched since he set it up. Luckily, Franz Boas was one of the less racist anthropologists of his time, but still, like, something you get a B minus for in 1920 is still going to be a big old F in 2021. Last I heard, there actually was a project to update it for which they'd hired some indigenous curators, so I'm optimistic about that. Our museums are absolutely not exempt. The fact that we even have Native American objects in museums that are largely mislabeled, sometimes they're attributed to tribes that are completely off base. Sometimes their functions are incorrectly described. I worked in a museum that had a lot of Native American collections, and we were considered one of the ones that was doing better about repatriation, but I still remember encountering an attitude of not wanting to display certain objects because then descendant communities would become aware of them and ask for them to be repatriated. I also think that there's something a little bit tasteless in the way that we construct museum exhibits around Native American cultures, that we seem to so often freeze them at the time of contact with Europe, as if they did not continue existing and are not still existing today.
Right.
So just the fact that descendant communities are very rarely consulted in putting together museum exhibits, I think speaks to our attitude of also seeing ourselves as conquerors.
And in your opinion, what are some things that, you know, people are currently doing in the modern anthropology circle, and what are some things that you're seeing in the future that can help change some of these systemic issues?
So a big thing that I already mentioned is including descendant communities. And that's something that I am seeing more and more in the way that museums approach exhibitions these days. In fact, in my freshman year of college, I had the opportunity to help with the research for a museum exhibit on the Urban Indian Relocation Act. So I helped transcribe oral interviews with Native American people who had been forcibly or coercively relocated from reservations into urban cities in the 1950s through 60s. And so what was cool about that was that one of the people that we interviewed was at the heart of the project, that it was someone who was directly impacted by it, who actually had helped formulate the idea and was consulted at every stage of the exhibition. And also that the work had a positive impact on the existing community in that it was used to help create historical protections for the Oakland Friendship House. So it was approached with this attitude of, we are telling the story of people who have been ignored and silenced, with those people telling us how to do it and correcting us along the way, and in such a way that will create positive change for people who have been impacted by this. And so the more that I see anthropologists approach museums with that idea of including the voices they're trying to represent, of questioning which histories we're telling and why, I think that that's great. I would also love to see anthropology be more self-critical and including audiences in that criticism. So one of the things I was talking to Sophia about is I think that when museums mess up, it's a great opportunity to teach the public about why museums are so fallible. So when you look at exhibits that have fallen into really making judgments about cultures and misrepresenting them, when that gets pointed out, they often take the exhibit down. I think absolutely take the exhibit down if it's creating ongoing harm for a community, but I don't think they should pretend that it never happened. Instead, I think it's an opportunity for museums to teach about, this is why this anthropologist spoke about this culture in this way, because this was the pervasive attitude of anthropology at the time, and this is how that affects the way that it was studied for years after, and giving people the tools and resources they need to see the same trends that I'm talking to you about, so that the next time they go into a museum and they see a culture presented a certain way, they have the resources necessary to ask themselves, is this accurate? Is this serving someone else's agenda? What information is being left out?
And it's so great that you're saying this, because I do feel like, as someone who's not a subject matter expert, when you go into a place like a museum, your assumption is that everything that you're seeing, everything that you're reading, and everything around you is completely authentic because there's a whole panel or investors and a whole group of people that are in charge of making sure that information is correct. Accountability, like you said, and not just doxing it and acting like it never existed, is important for someone who has no type of connection to what is being shared in a space like a museum.
As long as we keep moving in a direction where we're critical of the work that we're doing in the present day, then that seems to reflect an attitude of wanting to do better and trying to do better and learning more. And so I hope anthropology continues to be open to criticism and to genuinely listen to the things that it's doing wrong, because anthropology sells itself as this factual science about who people are. It has the power to do such massive harm when it gets it wrong.
And has done massive harm.
Exactly. That's how we know what the consequences are, because we've lived them, because the consequences have been eugenics and the continuation of slavery and Jim Crow and all of these other terrible things that we are still contending with today. Anthropology, if we take it as fact, will always cause harm, because it will always be leaving someone out. What we have to do is ask ourselves, what harm are we creating now? How can we avoid that harm in the future? How can we repair the harm we've already done? As long as anthropology remains cognizant of this, which again, I do feel it is now, but can always do better, then the direction we're heading in should be one of repairing the harm of the past and hopefully avoiding harm in the future.
You really wrapped that up nicely with a bow.
Yeah, well, you're outstanding. You are honest. You are genuine. And I really appreciate how wonderfully articulate you are for something that is so deeply complicated. I know that you are just touching the tip of the iceberg when it comes to anthropology. So thank you for, you know, making this such an engaging conversation for us, because I feel like it's going to put another thing on all of our listeners' radars.
Yeah, and I really appreciate that both of you mentioned that your goal here is just to create a starting point for people, because I absolutely have not covered all of the different issues with anthropology or even all of the different aspects of the issues I brought up. If I have one hope for this, it's that people get inspired to look more into anthropology, because I think it's so fascinating, but also it has so much impact on the way that we approach history and sociology and all of these other cultural studies.
Yeah, and I think one takeaway too for everyone listening is they'll be able to consider how history was written, but also how we're currently writing history today.
Amazing. Do you have any other books, websites, or social media accounts, or any type of media accounts that you want to plug? And share your sister, the name of your sister's podcast,
yeah,
as
share
well.
Your sister's podcast. This is-
yes, I absolutely want to plug my sister's podcast. I promised her I'd help her do PR for it. It's called Book Dumb. Dumb as in D-U-M-B. She does it with her friend August. Her name is Kendra. They both have master's degrees in literature, and they talk about the books that they're reading, books that they've read in the past, the joys of reading, but also some of the challenges of it. So it's really fun if you're someone who reads, just to listen to them talk about what they're into.
This is a beautiful place to start and, I guess, end. Thank you so much, Callan.
Yeah, thanks for having me on the podcast.
And with that, we just wanted to say thank you guys for returning and tuning in.
As we'd like to emphasize, we're just here to spark something for everyday people who do everyday things that have the magic to make differences everywhere.
With that being said, if you're feeling in the mood, leave us a review and follow us on Instagram, if you don't already, @Platinum Rule Podcast.
Bye.